Hello. We are recording again.
Yes, we are.
This is a continuation of a conversation we had. Do you want to recap the first one, maybe? Just what
sure.
It was about?
Sure. So we started off, you know, in our minds, we're trying to have a series of discussions where we discuss some of the most important elements of, Brian, your work right now. And your work is at a period or phase where it really requires airing out in discussion in sort of a critical but supportive and helpful and interesting context. And so I'm deeply interested in what you're working on, both in terms of the content and also how you're working, how you're thinking about research, how you're thinking about writing, how it intersects with literature, and how it also intersects with the public and how we translate our knowledge into different forms of communication with the public. So the first discussion we had dove into a Buddhist tradition that's called dependent origination, and that has been explored for millennia around unique ways of thinking about causality. And you have a blog post about dependent origination and not only the sort of theoretical or conceptual framework, but also the practice. It is a practice fundamentally of trying to dig into the multiple entry points of understanding the cause and ultimately the cause of our suffering. And we talked about how that perspective on causality is quite different from Western approaches. And then we launched into a second discussion on a paper by Cleland that looked at the differences in ways of thinking about causality and science from a either historical science perspective versus a experimental science perspective. And we really dug into thinking about the implications of those two approaches to understanding reasoning. So I think that maybe is a summary of where we went.
Yeah, that's really good. And in dependent origination, I'm often thinking about causality as opposed to conditionality. And so, yeah, I suppose we made that kind of distinction. I don't know whether those are the best words to use for the kind of forward order, linear, A causes B, B causes C, and so on. Whereas the dependent origination view, especially in the reverse order, is not really about that kind of causality, right? It's that causal understanding in the Buddhist view is kind of backwards. I suppose it's the difference between sufficient causes and necessary conditions, right?
Can you say a little bit more about that? I think that there's something really important there and what you mean by backwards.
Yeah, so when I say backwards, I mean we have this impression that things have a simple causal ordering. So, you know, in the article I give the example that I get an annoying text and that causes me to be upset, right? But in some sense that can't, strictly speaking, be the order of events because there's these interpretive layers of I look at the text, then I read it, then I kind of interpret it, and only later does that story kind of conflict with another one, and then I generate a kind of new story that integrates the other one, this new fact, and then this produces a kind of self-view at the end. Mm-hmm. So the self-view at the end is the kind of offended self, but in the Buddhist view, you know, it's not that there is a pre-existing self which is offended by the text. It's that at the end of this process, an offended self arises in response to another situation.
Yes.
Then it's kind of like a backwards inference to say, well, there must have been a self there. If now there's a disturbance, there must have been something before that had been disturbed.
Yes.
And so that is a kind of understanding of there's conditions that are necessary for each of those steps to be taken, but it's not strictly speaking causal. And causality in many cases seems to be kind of illusory when you look at it more closely, as in, yeah, it's a little hard to describe.
It does make sense. And I just, you know, on the one hand, it's illusory, and I think we spent a good hour, maybe even more, the first time trying to take apart these pieces. But I wanted to try out my own understanding to see if it, A, is right, and B, makes clearer to those who know some of the science that's coming out in neuroscience in particular. So you've read quite a bit of Anil Seth's work. Friston also talks about this kind of predictive coding that we do, this inference that we do, inference. That
active
the brain is doing,
right?
Active inference, exactly. That the brain is doing second by second all the time. And what becomes really clear, both empirically and phenomenologically, if it's investigated, is that we have these preset baseline conditions that are really from the past, that are set through patterns and conditionality, so that we can only perceive certain things out in the environment and are completely oblivious to the vast majority of other quote-unquote information there. And so for me, what's really interesting about what you're talking about when you talk about dependent origination is that this, we think that we are a self looking out into the world and we perceive some objective thing out there that gets into our mind and we process it, right? As opposed to, I'm making it up internally. I am creating the thing out in the world that is being seen and perceived and then attended to and acted upon. And so it's that backward causality as well that I think Anil Seth's work illuminates in a more biological way. Do I have that right? Is that a good sense of an example?
Yes, I think so. I'll try to summarize my understanding of Anil's idea. He's saying that rather than we tend to have this assumption that we are perceiving the world relatively transparently, right? So that the world is coming in at us through the senses. And what we are experiencing is reality. It's the world, right? It's coming in and it's not filtered or processed. This is what's really out there. And his model is saying that much more of it is to do with what we predict to be out there, and that the sensations that we experience themselves may be better understood as like prediction errors of what we expected to encounter. And that may seem kind of abstract, but I think it relates a lot to autopilot, you know, just this idea that there's a lot of things you do in the day that aren't really conscious, you know, and you don't really think about them as you go through these kind of motions. And when something grabs your attention in your, let's say, your morning routine, you're out of toothpaste or whatever, then like something's gone wrong. And so it's almost like a prediction has been violated and it grabs attention. So that seems like a minor example, but I think in the active inference framework, this is kind of going on all the time, right? Which is that the way attention is directed is actually, we have this impression that there's like a self-directing attention outward towards this objective, you know, static world. But in the active inference view, it's more like the brain is constantly making unconscious predictions about what's going on. And what we experience is mostly, or maybe entirely, I think he may think that it's entirely the violation of those predictions.
Absolutely. And so here, this is absolutely right. And I think that this is commensurate with what the Buddhists in the dependent origination are calling disturbances, right? And so this is the backwardsness of it. And I'm linking the neuroscience that many people, if they've seen the TED Talk by Anil Seth, really he hammers this non-intuitive causal chain. It is our own internal machinations that are actually part of the causal chain or causal network that bring into perception the world out there. It is not the world out there that impinges on us and then we interpret that. So this is the backwardness that I feel is a part of what, when we practice dependent origination, becomes clearer.
Yes. It's almost like the dreamlike nature of perception itself, right? So we can be conscious in a dream as well, and we kind of think we understand the difference between these things. But I think, you know, for Anil, and also for, you know, we've talked about the Nietzsche example, where a book falling in the room while you're sleeping becomes a gunshot going off in the dream.
Yes.
In Jonathan Hillis Miller's paper on the disarticulation of the self in Nietzsche from 1981. And in that example, it kind of shows the order of events more clearly, because we can see that, in fact, something about the book falling, the noise coming in, has some kind of physiological arousal. And it's only a secondary step that we think, well, what was that? And this is an unconscious process, right? And so in the dream, it produces this prediction that a gunshot must have just gone off, right? Whereas if we're awake, we think, if we see the book fall, we think we understand what's just happened. And this is not because there's a fundamental difference between these two, but because there's a difference in speed, sort of. And so if I've got my back turned and the book falls, then there's still this kind of attempt to infer what has just happened. And that is, at its heart, what dependent origination is about. It's basically about a deliberate practice of understanding the process of backwards inference on present effects, basically. So you're trying to understand what must have caused this, what had to have happened for this to be the case, right?
Right. Yeah. And so this is, you have talked about it as detective work. It's a deconstruction and a reconstruction.
Yes.
And you're doing it, you know, what I find perhaps most compelling is you're doing it from different entry points, different possibilities, so that you're playing with causality in a way that you realize it is the starting points are not arbitrary, but can be seen as conditions, just conditions, that there isn't that one particular interpretation that you have in your own mind of what caused the disturbance. And that's the only one, which is so what we're conditioned to do all our lives, is to think about these things in very linear ways. And we've trained our perception also to, or we've trained our mind to think about our perception system in that way as well.
Yes.
So one of the things that I was really wanting to dive into today is, you know, we've started to some degree at the end, or not end, but somewhere at the end around thinking about dependent origination, what's so compelling about it for you, and how it's helping both to understand your own experience of suffering and alleviation of that suffering, and also to understand a huge swath of thinkers and scientists and scholars and how they approach their work and how they think in genuinely unique and interesting ways that we need to think deeper about. So what I wanted to start, or not start, but continue with you about, is to have you tell us a little bit about what got you into philosophy and how you think philosophy is right now important and useful in terms of scholarship, but also in terms of our own experience of living. I know that's a broad question, but take it where you want to take it.
Yeah, so I think I'll talk a little bit about my personal history. So in high school, I had a reasonably good introduction to philosophy class. I think it may have just been like a semester long. Maybe it was a year, but I think it was just a semester. And that was right at the end. And this got me kind of more than anything, it got me familiar with a bunch of the names in Western philosophy and a very cursory kind of overview of their thinking. I think we had like some kind of illustrated textbook, which is quite funny in retrospect, but probably not a bad one. Like I think it was reasonably good. And when I went to Princeton, I thought I was going to study philosophy. I actually really assumed that was what I wanted to do. It's very funny, you know, like just to think about what I thought philosophy was then and how it's changed over time. I don't know if you looked at that Brian McGee article about, you know, it was an article about the swings between sort of obscurantism or just like difficult prose within philosophy and like clear prose and how it kind of swings back and forth. But he's trying to make this distinction and saying, you know, like, you know, someone might assume that philosophy is a kind of genre or style of writing, in which case, you know, it's comparable to something like to be an essayist or to be a poet. Mm-hmm. But then he says, you know, if that were the case, then it would be impossible for you to be a bad writer, but a good philosopher. Because he says that it's impossible to be a bad writer, but a good essayist, or a bad writer, but a good poet. And he's like, it is actually possible to be a bad writer, but a good philosopher.
Yes.
And I think he cites Kant and Locke and a few others, whereas he really admires the style of certain other ones like Plato, as well as Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, who are just insanely good as stylists and writers. And so it's kind of interesting to think about what I thought philosophy was going into university, because I ended up studying literature. And maybe I did think something like this, that it was more associated with literature than I actually found it to be. Because when I took my first introductory philosophy class, which was an intro to logic, I was like, this is just like math.
Terrible.
Like, yeah, exactly. What is this? And so where I found what I understood philosophy to be was in Russian literature and in East Asian studies, Chinese intellectual history. Mm-hmm. And so that probably tells you something about how I wound up where I am today in terms of like thinking about things like Taoism, certainly. I didn't really encounter Buddhism until about 5 years ago. So that was about, you know, at least a decade after I'd encountered Taoism.
But could you make that more explicit? Like what, when you say it's literature and Chinese philosophy, what is philosophy there compared to, you know, the other type, the mathematical type?
I think I had an understanding of what philosophical questions were, or the questions that I was interested in. And, you know, although I just said I didn't encounter Buddhism until much later, a central one was, why do we suffer? Another one at that time that I think even goes back to university is, how do we know anything? And I think that relates to very old problems in philosophy, things like the problem of the criterion, where basically you have to understand, you know, in order to justify something, you're going to have to bring something else in, and how do you justify that, and does it lead to infinite regress and things like that. But at the time, I didn't really have the language to formulate any of that. But those were the kinds of questions that I wanted answers to. And I couldn't see how a closed system like formal logic was ever going to answer a question like, why do we suffer? Or a question like, how do we know things? Because, you know, there's a kind of, at least I experienced it as a kind of geometric aspect to formal logic. And maybe, you know, I just didn't persist long enough and I would have gotten into the kinds of philosophy that I was thinking about. But I do think that there's a strong analytic streak, both in the States and especially in those two places, as opposed to the rest of Europe, for example. And that, you know, this is now called, it's this idea of there's analytic and continental philosophy, which kind of splits sometime in the 20th century.
Right.
And I suppose, you know, maybe this relates to your question is, like, I thought that if philosophy didn't improve our daily experience, then I kind of, like, wasn't interested in it. And yes. What I did find within both Russian literature and Chinese philosophy was a deep concern with those kind of questions and also attempts to answer them, right?
Yes. So what I find fascinating, and I think we've maybe touched on this before, is that it was basically the same impasse for me with psychology and literature. So I went into psychology believing, because I was deeply concerned with the human condition. I wanted to know more about suffering, yes, but also how, you know, love comes about and what its weird logic and its own sense of, you know, ruling our ways of being with one another. And I wanted to understand how relationships, you know, develop and dissolve. I wanted to understand all of these kinds of, you know, how we can perceive the exact same thing in utterly different ways, depending on our emotional states, all those things. And psychology, to me, I thought that's what psychology was going to be about. And indeed, people like Freud and others, Piaget from a more developmental perspective, and Vygotsky and all sorts of others, Jung, you know, promised me these kinds of really deep, rich theoretical frameworks. And what instead I got, eventually when I learned what contemporary psychology was, you know, the hangover from the behaviorists, which was this kind of tearing apart of and modularizing and mechanizing the human condition, right? And literature, exactly the literature that you liked, but also things, you know, people like Virginia Woolf, and poetry, like, you know, all sorts of poets, Emily Dickinson and others, gave me a much better sense of what I was looking for, interestingly. So I'd love to go a little bit deeper with you to hear two things from you. One, so you've just told me...
Wait, can I respond to that first?
Please, please.
So it's interesting that you... So in other words, you know, it is this kind of search for the human condition. And at some point, I really want to go into Hannah Arendt on a much deeper level than I have so far. But that book is phenomenal. And yeah, is going to be really important, I think, for the discussions that we're going to have.
Yes.
But it's funny to go and search of the human condition, knowing something about the history of these questions. And this led me to think that philosophy was the answer. It led you, because, as you said, of Freud and William James and Vygotsky and people like that, that towards psychology. But then what I found, you know, that philosophy had kind of been drained of philosophy and left with something like mathematics, like a kind of pale shadow of mathematics, whereas psychology, it sounds like from your description, had become a kind of like charade of, you know, chemistry or something like yeah. experimental science, right? Like an attempt yeah. to do experimental science rather than to grapple with the questions that it was potentially looking at in like the 1890s, 1910s or something.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's really important, because I think we both had, and I think many, many other people do, a hunger for understanding both ourselves in relation to other people and the world, and then also by extension, science and how we do science and what kinds of questions we can answer by different approaches to science and so on. So I think it relates also to our past conversations. And I want to understand now, you know, after being disillusioned by analytic philosophy, where you went next. You know, you found some of what you were interested in literature, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. And then I'd like to hear about the kind of philosophy that is deeply interesting and compelling you right now.
Yeah, so literature, as much as I loved it then and still love it, and really I don't feel complete when I'm not reading good literature. So I think it is of absolutely paramount importance in education, and, you know, the amount that's contained in literature, and I, you know, I don't want to get into the debate about classics or anything like that, but I've just gotten so much out of it. You know, in many ways, I feel some kind of duty or obligation. It's not even like I feel like a duty to educate someone else or something like that. It's like I feel a sense of vocation to contribute something back because I've gotten so much from books. And it feels like what I've gained from literature is somehow unfair. And that I basically, yeah, I mean, somehow that
feeling, that's interesting,
is always driving the writing, I would say. And the desire to be some sort of a conduit for the power of the voices that have come into me or something like that.
That's really beautiful. Just to jump in here is that this to me is exactly what Lewis Hyde talks about in The Gift, which is that, you know, real art cannot be, you could sell it, but real art is an act of gift giving. And you receive it in a way that is open, and it is not transactional. But there is a sense, if that gift has had a real heartfelt impact on you, that you want to give back. Again, not yes. instrumentally and not in any kind of
transactional,
but yes. it compels you to want to give back. So I love what you're saying. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I think The Gift is like a I have not read that book, or I think I started it, but I haven't finished it like so many other books. But The Gift sort of metaphor is perfect because it's the feeling of having been given such a gift, to be showered so generously, and to be, it's like profligately, it's like, you know, exorbitantly, you know, given a gift. And then just the feeling afterwards, it actually has nothing to do with repayment in the sense yes. of owing anything to anyone. You know what I mean? Because, not least because many of the most profound experiences I've had on this level are from people who have been dead for at least decades, but quite often centuries and sometimes millennia, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. So it's not about that. You know, it's something different. It's more general. But it... Yeah, how this leads into philosophy is an interesting question too. I mean, I should say also that I'm very new to Western philosophy, which is that even though I had, you know, this high school class and I kind of had this aborted attempt to pursue it at university, I didn't really go into the primary sources or even the kind of like close secondary sources until like the last couple of years. And the first way I got into that, I had been writing a novel, and some of the questions in that novel were related to some of the same questions that I mentioned, which is like, how do we know anything? And that yes. led me into philosophy of science, and especially Thomas Kuhn, because I was really interested in revolutionary changes, like what you might call in complexity science, like phase transitions.
Yes.
Or, you know, just kind of nonlinear responses, let's say. Which, of course, even the idea that these happen, you know, whether it's in political systems or whether it's in, you know, economics or biology or whatever, is hotly contended still, right? It's not a settled matter. But there is a, you know, one side of this debate is convinced that we get misled by stable plateaus, which persist for a while. And there may be metastable, there's, you know, a local minimum or whatever, which gives the appearance of some kind of gradual change. And then we just kind of, because we draw our borders at the really drastic changes, then we think somehow that the gradual changes are where most of the action happens. Whereas the kind of catastrophist view, and this comes out of geology, as I think we've discussed before.
Yeah.
Originally, and then it kind of goes into Darwin, and it's still being debated in many different domains today. The catastrophist view is that most consequential changes are really nonlinear, and it's only from being in a kind of plateau that you can get this impression that things are usually, or that the most consequential changes come gradually. because right. you can't That's like, typically when you have like an extinction event or whatever, it's like you kind of can't see that that's happened because there's no one around afterwards or whatever.
Right. It's the punctuated equilibrium idea as well, right?
Exactly.
Which I think yeah. it's Gould and others. And I think that that's a really important concept to think about, both in science and in terms of our own kind of development. I'm wondering, just now it came to me, do you think that you were initially interested in revolutions so much because of your love of Tolstoy?
It's a good question. I'm curious, yeah, which part of Tolstoy makes you think of that?
I mean, revolution was the backdrop of a lot of, and it's what I find most interesting is that it's in the minutiae that you get to see the minutiae, and yet you also have this sense of, you know, large changes, whether it's war and peace or other, you know, so I just, it seems like it's such a great lens on both the micro interactions that are going on in physical systems, as well as these psychological systems and social systems that you get to watch in real detail and how they flip and go into these, yes. you know, catastrophically different states. So I'm just, you know.
Yeah, and he's definitely interested in these kind of big pivotal moments in history, as well as the right. kind of emergent effects, because
exactly.
you know, he's interested in beekeeping and things like that. And there, he sees in 1812, I mean, you know, he's writing in the kind of mid-19th century, and so he has sort of, I think it's Crimean War and things like that, where he's exposed to some of these things. But he does think in those terms, and he's sort of opposed to this great man theory of history. And so then he sees these kind of waves of history, like,
yes,
like they're kind of, yeah. And I could definitely see why you would connect that to revolutions. It's a good question, like what made me originally think about them. So one thing is I took some courses from the Santa Fe Institute a couple years ago, and one was on origins of life, which is amazing. And they talked a lot about complexity theory, and I was reading complexity theory papers, and I do yes. totally think that, especially, yeah, all of these, you know, complexity theory stuff is in Tolstoy, and it is in the Taoist writers. And there was something in that that it was making me think about, like, nonlinear responses. It was actually, like, at the same time I was reading a lot about the Mongol invasions and about this kind of, like, almost, like, viral spread of an idea, like a small change to a policy, which is, yes. like, rather than, you know, there's kind of, and I don't want to, like, butcher the history, but, you know, the people have been kind of fighting on horseback on the Eurasian steppe for 2,500 years or something like that. You know, you get these ancient Greek sources talking about it, but it's in a way kind of self-containing because of the way that the wars typically go, which is a kind of like mm-hmm. extermination thing. And so some people have argued that, you know, the big innovation of Genghis Khan is that he just allows people to live and join him. And that decision is very easy if it's like, mm-hmm. essentially assimilate or die. Most people, or enough people, choose assimilate that this is like a thing that can spread, right? Or even just like accepting converts might be like a thing, you know, you could think about the spread of Christianity or whatever, as opposed to maybe other cults that, you know, don't accept converts easily or something like that, which wouldn't grow necessarily in the same way. And so I think I was taking a class on complexity at the same time as I was reading about the Mongol invasions. And I thought that there was something in this, you know, this kind of, it's almost like a boiling over. And so you get these,
right.
you know, one of the things in complexity dynamics is about, well, complexity itself is defined, right, as this state that's neither too ordered nor too chaotic. It's like kind of this Goldilocks zone. And there's, yeah, I suppose, like, you know, nonlinear responses and phase transitions and things like that become more likely at this certain temperature. And so I was thinking a lot about the temperature of Eurasia in whatever it
yes.
is, the 11th century or something.
I think many of us who are drawn and just our minds are completely blown by complexity science. And of course, the entire Santa Fe Institute is based on this, is that there are a set of principles that have been observed to work across so many domains, whether it's psychological, biological, chemical, physical, geological. All of these domains have a set of principles that seem to fit and explain phenomena across these disciplines, to the degree that these disciplines no longer have the same edges that we have thought about. And I think part of your work and part of the power of your work is that, you know, I ask a question about literature and we are into the Mongols, and then we're into, you know, complexity science in different ways. And so things like, you know, sensitivity to initial conditions or small perturbations, the butterfly effect, right? Small perturbations have these large effects, as you were saying, this one rule of Genghis Khan having like, okay, we take on converts, can have this mammoth difference in terms of the, you know, turn of whole civilizations, phase transitions, but also this fluctuation, the fact that there are always fluctuations before there is a dramatic phase transition. I think these are all really important.
Yes, kind you see of little mini versions before the
reaction. Exactly.
People have been talking about this with the Reformation. Jan Hus and these kind of like early attempts to do something like the Reformation before the actual one kicks off.
That's right.
It's interesting that you use the word explain about these complexity dynamics, because it does feel like they have this really important explanatory power.
Yes.
But, you know, I suppose, you know, and this is kind of at odds with predictive power, isn't it?
Yes.
And so,
absolutely.
And so this is something we talked about last time, just the historical sciences versus the experimental sciences. Historical sciences, you know, produce the most compelling narrative of what has happened, and they're differentiated on this kind of smoking gun basis where you search for evidence for the best one, and once you get enough evidence, then you sort of, that story, it's not that it never changes again, but that, you know, you go with that one as the best story. Whereas in something like physics, the evidence kind of mounts from these repetitions over time, and because you get a better understanding of how the causes lead to effects, then it has predictive power, right? Whereas in the historical sciences, it's like you get a better understanding of what conditions are necessary for effects to have happened. But it actually doesn't, and maybe can't, give you insight into causality, you know?
Yeah. I think so. Just for listeners who didn't hear the previous episodes, this is Carol Cleland's paper, 2001, and then she has a longer chapter on the experimental versus historical sciences, and we'll put a link in the show notes. But I think it's a really important distinction, and again, this explanatory versus predictive approach is really important. And I think that part of my interest in psychology that I got much more through my examination of good literature is I was looking for the explanations of human nature, and they are usually in the particulars. And so literature does such a good job of going into the particulars of whole lives and so on, whereas psychology right now is trying to look at means.
Determine laws,
averages. Yeah. So tell me how that is commensurate to the fields that you're thinking about.
It's a great question. I think that they're complementary, and it's really important both to be able to drop down into the level of experience and evidence and kind of concrete things and the realm of history and literature, where you have these very individual stories. They kind of can't be abstracted. And yet then also understand the most kind of abstract physical laws and things like that that are at the kind of opposite end of the spectrum, or at least understand how that reasoning is done. And I think it relates to a question you were kind of asking earlier about which parts of philosophy I'm interested in, because it wasn't until, I suppose, I encountered Buddhism like 5 or 6 years ago, and this gave like a concrete practice that I could actually do, and that was supposed to kind of change perception or change attention, change, you know, ultimately uncertainty, anxiety, suffering, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Like it was supposed to change experience is maybe the shortest way to say it. And I didn't really understand before that how, like, conceptual understanding was supposed to change experience. Because you could, mm-hmm. you could seemingly kind of learn lots of things, read lots of great literature. You know, I have problems with George Steiner, I think, but, like, you know, he makes this point well, which is that, you know, Prussian art, or, you know what I mean, like German art did not stop World War One. Basically, I think this
right.
is what he's kind of like trying to say. There doesn't seem to be much link between whatever's going on in Austria and Germany, like Fondacieckla Vienna versus the First World War. And he, you know, some people say, well, this is, there's some great divide, you know, Stefan Zweig would kind of have you believe that. But Steiner is saying that they're kind of compatible. And I'm not trying to make a claim about that particular thing, but I would say in my own experience, no matter how much I felt that I gained from literature and loved it, it didn't make me any happier, I don't think.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
this
yeah.
is the thing that I felt like was missing. And so, and I think, yeah, so this kind of brought me to the, to a side of Buddhism, which it's kind of like the Theravada, like these are people who are really into the insight practices and things like that. And I say that as if I like met any of these people. Really, I just read their books, basically.
Yeah.
and sometimes their posts on the internet or something. I never really actually met anyone, and I'm certainly not part of any kind of lineage or whatever, but I did a lot of practice.
Yeah.
And that practical element, I think Buddhism was the first one that really made me realize the importance of doing some kind of practice over time. And that's leading into mm-hmm. what I'm thinking about now. Right now, I'm really interested in Puranism, because that also seems to be a form of practice, actually. It's widely misunderstood to be a kind of skeptical epistemological position, like a position that things can't be known.
Yes.
But in my view, it's better understood as a commitment to undermining views in like a very practical way, especially mm-hmm. views that things are good or bad by nature. And then once you've done that, remaining open to investigation. Because I think, I don't know, like earlier I was thinking, you know, both with your experience in psychology and, you know, my experience of academic philosophy, you know, you could make some kind of comment about a meaning crisis. I feel like when I hear about a meaning crisis, like people are kind of assuming that either there's some meaning we once had that was lost, or we've got to like now build a new meaning and like stick to that or something like that. Whereas like the Puranist approach would be like, no, what's meaningful is like the process of investigation and
yes.
the practice of trying to figure these things out. It's not the destination. And anytime you think you're nearing a destination under the Puranist and probably also Buddhist and Taoist understandings, you're probably in quite grave danger, right?
So I think this is really great. So I think you're, to some degree, describing a pragmatic approach to philosophy, and that is what you're looking for, right? Something useful that you can use, that we can all use,
yes.
that is a practice, but also, you know, not only a meditation practice or a other types of practice, but also a way of thinking rather than the thing to think.
Yes,
and
it's methodological.
Exactly. And so I'm really interested in hearing from you, and I know it might be a longer story, what the history of philosophy is. So was there a time, my understanding it was, and it's such a naive and very surface understanding, that
That's
philosophy
okay.
started, well, nowhere close to mine. So didn't philosophy start as an endeavor to find out what the good life would be and how to reach it, or some practices basically to find that? And wasn't it supposed to be a living thing that we worked at, the every man, every woman, everything in between could do? And where did that,
yes,
where did that, if that's that naive kind of understanding is true, where did it diverge into something that in my mind became abstracted and a almost academic pursuit from there on.
I mean, I'm tempted just to kind of blame Plato and Kant, but like, I think that's like oversimplifying. I mean, I do think that there is something in Athens going on, and there is something in German idealism going on that has some of the problems that you've named. So philosophy itself is a kind of loaded term, right? Some people want to say it's only this thing that has this lineage going back to ancient Greece, even though if you read Diogenes Laertius, who's notoriously kind of problematic source, but he's kind of all we've got in terms of a lot of these sort there. I mean, there are other traditions and things like that, but in terms of like things you can pick up and read as a book on a lot of the pre-Socratics or whatever, there's not a huge amount else. That's not entirely true, but let's just leave it for now. But like, even, you know, when you read him, the first thing that he says in his Lives of Eminent Philosophers, it's basically like, some people say that, you know, philosophy comes from the Magi or the Gymnosophists, or, you know, this is like a pairing that's said in ancient Greece. And so, like, basically that either it's Persian or Indian in origin, or maybe even North African, like, because the Greeks really respected the Egyptians, right? And so, but then he tries to argue against this, but it's almost like he protests too much. You know, it's like, he tries to say it's obvious that it starts in Greece. And it's like,
right,
if it's so obvious, like, why do you need to make this point? Like, can't you just start the book or whatever?
Yes.
Like, and so it seems, and I have asked sort of, you know, the odd like classics professor and stuff like that what they think about this, because there are a lot of reports of the pre-Socratics, but also, you know, Epicurus and others going to India. Pyrrho went with Alexander.
Yes.
And so then there is this question of how much influence was there. And I forget.
Sorry, just to interrupt, so that it's clear what you are claiming, and with some evidence from other thinkers, you're not the only one, is that Greek philosophers and Greek philosophy did not originate solely from Greece or in that whole area, but that they appropriated, they used, they were influenced by Egypt and India and other traditions, Eastern yes. traditions. Is that correct?
That's right. So, okay. So if you're saying, what did philosophy start as? It's a complicated yes. question, because no one really knows where philosophy started. Most people assume
Great.
That it kind of starts in Athens between Homer and Plato, right? Like that somewhere, somehow mm-hmm. it starts mm-hmm. in Greece, in one of these places. Sorry, it's wrong to say Athens, because there's people in Miletus and people in all kinds of other parts, like some of which are in Asia Minor or whatever, and some of which are would now be like Greek islands or things like that. But let's just take that story. So I think the mainstream account aligns with what you're saying, which is that there were a bunch of these different schools, kind of Platonists, Aristotelians, eventually Stoics and Epicureans. And what they were all interested in were philosophies of living, right? Which is that mm-hmm. the goal is eudaimonia, which is like flourishing. And the question is, how do we get there? And most of their advice is like reasonably practical and has sort of consequences for how you live your life, and is not this kind of abstruse, you know, analytic stuff that basically is of questionable value to sort of ethical or pragmatic concerns, right? In the same way that mm-hmm. in general, learning, getting really, really good at math is of questionable value ethically or pragmatically. Like, yes, you might work in an area where mathematics is really useful, but equally you might work in an area where analytic philosophy is very useful. And like, that's, but in terms of like, does it lead to a good life, is not, it's not obvious how it would. At least
my
it's
kids
not obvious
completely
to me.
Agree with you that math is completely useless at this point. So I think this is really important, and I think the way that I remember sitting in on some of the inter-intellect salons that you ran early on, where you looked at Epicurean and just different schools of Stoic philosophy and so on, and you know, one of the messages that I heard was that there was also a case being made for trial and error, right? Things were being tried, you know, and they were wildly different from one another. And, you know, the hedonists versus, you know, and what's really interesting about that period is it felt like people were genuinely struggling to figure out these basic questions and answers in their own lives. And it feels to me like, A, we have not answered it. I mean, there's certainly many, many people going to the Stoics and so on to find the answers to their own unhappiness and healing and to Buddhism and all that. So I find it just so important that those are the roots. And I don't know that most people, most listeners to something like this would know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, this relates to a question that I don't know if this is the right place to talk about it, but just this axial age question that I think it starts in Carl Jaspers. And there's just been an article out recently about Carl Jaspers and about how he's kind of forgotten and had this influence on Heidegger and Hannah Arendt. But like his question is like, why is it that the Old Testament is being written and Socrates is born and the Buddha is born and Lao Tzu, you know, the kind of Taoist philosopher seems to be alive around this time. Zoroaster, it looks increasingly likely, is also around at some point. His dating is very, very hard. But like, you know, why over just like a short span? And some, you know, depending how you divide it up, some of the really key figures are all alive in like the same year, basically. And you're like, what is going on here? And this kind of led to, you know, an argument that some kind of fundamental shift in consciousness is going on, or some kind of awareness. And I actually think that that is more plausible than it sounds on the face of it. I mean, this is pretty much like Julian Jaynes's argument. I would say that to some degree it's contained in Nietzsche, and that probably Ian McGilchrist would also thinks that there is something pretty fundamental going on around this time. Actually, David Graeber as well, you know, in Debt, he's kind of looking at this period. And actually, we're about to read this book, 1177 BC, about the late Bronze Age collapse, because it may all kind of relate somehow to that, which is that there's some kind of fundamental thing, like relatively large scale thing going on in Eurasia, but confusingly, maybe also in Latin America, which is like the thing that's like, why are these changes happening? Anyway.
Well, so wouldn't that be interesting, right? If there is these system changes, this real difference in how the brain functions and how our minds function because of some kind of social element or some kind of threshold that in both places humanity might have reached. And I just wanted to ask you to please to be a little more specific about what you're talking about, the it. So Julian Jaynes has an it and these other people have an it. What do you mean exactly?
Well, they're just pointing to the fact that it seems to be in this relatively constrained time period that some big shift occurs, and especially like a lot of religions are starting. So like, why is it that, you know, monotheism starts at the same time as Buddhism, as this, which is the same time as Confucianism, which is the same time, as, you know? And so I think some version of the axial age theory, which is that there is some big shift going on in that period.
Yes.
And yeah, there's, I can't remember how exactly I got onto that, but I am really interested in that question. I think it does demand an account. Like, it's just a simpler explanation that something fundamental shifted in that period than it is to try to explain how, you know, without exception, all writing before a certain period, like 1000 BC, writes as if gods are present, right, among people, and that they talk to them all the time.
Right.
Like, how do you explain that if it's not a shift in consciousness? Like, so, and presumably you're also arguing that it's not that actually gods were around. So, like,
right.
You know what I mean?
So I think we got here because you were saying, how is it that all of these philosophers and schools of thought are being, in a very short span of time, are being developed and experimented with and so on. And then that's how you linked it to this large scale, right?
Well, and I'll just say what I think. I think a sophisticated kind of self-consciousness is new. Like, basically, that individual self-consciousness, it's not that it never happened in 1000 BC, but it was probably kind of rare and only happened under certain circumstances. And that became increasingly common first among rich people, like Athenian slaveholders or people like the Buddha, and then eventually kind of comes to affect larger and larger percentage of the population. I know it's a big claim, and it's one that's very hard to defend in a short period of time. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's my working hypothesis, is what I would say, is that like something changed with regard to an understanding of what the self is over time. And right. it happened relatively quickly, and it spread across cultures like quickly and had very big effects on the cultures that it affected. But that same shift may even have been happening in the 20th century in some places. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. that's like really contentious. And like Jaynes is kind of emphatic on the point that one is not better than the other, like modes of consciousness. Yeah. Like it's not like being self-conscious has severe downsides, as I think most of us have probably experienced in one way or another.
Right.
Whereas, you know, vibing or whatever you want to call what preceded it, like it may have some disadvantages in terms of planning or something like that, but it also has advantages in terms of, you know, connectedness to a community and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
So if something is changing with respect to the self in that period, then it's like people are generating lots of ideas about like, what do we do with this? And it may even be that rationality itself, like linear kind of reasoning, which may have some relation to more people getting literate, mm-hmm. like that's like a technology that people are like, what do we do with this? You know, like in the same yeah. way that like AI comes online right now, or, you know, GPT starts generating text, and we're like, uh-oh, seems like this is the thing. What's this going to do? And like something like Aristotelian logic may come online in a lot of places all at once. And they're like, oh, damn, now we can kind of reason anything. And I think a lot of people listening will probably think, well, no, you can't. Logic, you know, determines what you can reason to. And it's like, well, yeah. kind of. Although when you look at the problems that Plato's having with the sophists, and there's not equivalent, but there's other kinds of sophists in China, they do seem to be, it's kind of like rhetoric and oratory, right, become these arts, and persuasion, you know. So it's not yes. necessarily strictly speaking like rigorous Aristotelian logic that we're talking about, but people seeing, they're like, oh, there's this thing where you can use these abstract concepts to make a point. And they start using this in ways that maybe they hadn't before. And I'm not yeah. going to like strongly argue that, but I think there is this sense of like a discovery or like a new invention, really. And then they're like,
yeah.
what do we do with this? And everyone's kind of grappling with that question. And so then over the period, let's say 500 BC to like, you know, around the time of Christ, there's like a, and even especially earlier in that period, let's say 600 BC to like 200 BC, there's really like an explosion of different understandings of things like, how do we know things? Like, what does it yeah. mean to be certain of things? And all these questions that just didn't previously arise. Or maybe they did. I mean, I could be totally wrong in that they did arise in many cultures in many periods before, but we don't really have a lot of evidence of that, I guess.
Right. And I do like the hypothesis, or the sort of structure of the hypothesis, because again, it's this kind of small perturbation of a kind that might be happening in different places around the world. And it leads to a necessity to adjust to it, right? To adjust. You use the example of AI. In terms of ontogeny, I think about, you know, at around 3.5, 4, you suddenly, you know, the cognitive system reorganizes such that you have theory of mind and you're able to understand that other people have, you know, not only separate minds than yours, but can think entirely different things about the same event or about yourself even than you do. And it's this like creeping sense of what the frick is going on, right? Mm. And you have to adjust to it. And one of the you know, more interesting hypotheses that some of us worked on and thought about was that this, the onset of theory of mind, very basic theory of mind, brought about a huge feelings of shame, an uncomfortable sense of shame, because you suddenly realize that others can think you're bad even when you're not bad, or you didn't think of yourself as bad. So that sense of shame is so uncomfortable, so unpleasant, that you have to do something about it, right? Mm. And so you create things like defenses, and you create personality structures that help you adjust to that. And they're abstracted senses of the self, right? They are abstracted ways of working with painful experiences around you. And so I wonder if a similar thing at a civilization or societal level is happening, when there is this change in, I don't know what you call it, but these, and actually changes in various ways of thinking. And if, you know, for example, the internalization of the gods, where they would be internal, are now externalized, and what you have to do to adjust your societal structures now is just fascinating to think about. That's all.
Totally. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with Jaspers and the Axial Age, there's lots, you know, people have poked all kinds of holes in it. And, you know, Ruth Benedict has The Chrysanthemum and the Sword about shame cultures versus guilt cultures, things like that. And, you know, and we've talked before about recapitulation theory, this idea, I think, in biology that, you know, the kind of fetus of an animal like goes through all these earlier evolutionary stages, which is not strictly true. And yet there is something to these ideas. Like, you know, if you think that other animals don't have the same degree of theory of mind that humans do, then something must have changed at some point, right? So then drawing an analogy to the development of theory of mind in the individual to a kind of collective theory of mind, like, I do want to at least like hold space for that idea, even if like it has risks, right? To put things in these kind of, you know, it risks infantilizing past cultures in a way that they shouldn't be infantilized, you know. At the same time, you know, there had to be like, you know, if you think something's changed, then like,
but we don't have to be teleological about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? We don't have to say that these are more primitive. What we can do is describe and then try to explain the conditions, right? The context and the constraints that in some way, going back to dependent origination, from different angles provide the conditions for type of self-organization that is principled and follows the same principles across, right, different areas and so on. So what would be interesting is to identify these conditions that set the conditionality for these causal arisings, right? So, and there's no, there does not have to be any sense of
directionality,
exactly. Mm.
Or progress, which is also,
or like progress.
I think that's right. And I am really interested in this kind of weak recapitulation theory idea. You know, it on some level it must be true. You know, it's like if we have language and at one point we didn't, then something had to have changed and language had to have developed. And more likely than not, it evolved, right? Like a lot of these things are about our evolutionary processes, it seems like. And that's its own minefield in terms of the history of how evolutionary theory has been used in the social sciences in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But at the same time, it is coming back. And I think it's important that a better understanding, you know, that's not so focused on the competitive element, because I've said before that in Darwin, he provides a lot of space for other explanations. He wants to argue for natural selection, but he doesn't think it's the only thing. He thinks competition is important. And I think it is important to get to the level of variability that he needs for the whole thing to actually work. But, you know, other people like Kropotkin are looking at the importance of cooperation rather than, you know, just strictly competition, because we see cooperation everywhere. You know, he went to Siberia looking, you know, with a kind of Darwinian outlook, expecting to see in this hostile environment something like a, you know, Hobbesian, whatever, war of all against all. But what he found was like intense cooperation. And, you know, I think that's going to come in even more important. I mean,
really important.
It's kind of in the air in terms of, you know, the importance of the microbiome in humans or the importance of mycelia in, you know, the roots of plants and things like that.
Yeah, and Franz de Waal's work with bonobos versus chimps and the interesting kind of, you know, they co-evolve, but they're different strategies of being in small groups and the competitive versus the cooperativeness of bonobos is fascinating to look at their different solution to a similar sort of organizational problem. So what I, you know, let's say we have about 10 more minutes to go. If yes. you have 10 minutes in you, we, you know, touched on where philosophy started and the idea that there was a focus on the usefulness of philosophy and that it should be a part of our lives in a way that helps us live better lives.
Yes.
Of less suffering. And then we went into, you know, what turned you so off on, you know, the analytic philosophy approach and why it didn't seem to be useful, essentially. And I want to hear if you feel like sharing right now the place you have or you're now most excited to kind of work in and the middle way, maybe, if you will, of where you've come to.
Yeah, so I think I had always a kind of pragmatist bent in the sense that I was interested in practical philosophies and I was interested in trying them out. I actually have very little interest in beliefs, which sounds maybe weird because I have all kinds of weird theories and things like that. But I kind of think of philosophy or maybe just books in general as like a way of trying on someone else's perspective or trying out their mind in a certain sense. And in order to do that, you kind of have to give yourself over to it. You have to let the skeptic step aside, even though, you know, I'm a great lover of skepticism, which is like the other kind of odd paradox about this. But I think where I've come to is like, it's important to kind of go through the history of philosophy, not as a way of like showing off, not as a way of like learning about it just for the sake of learning, but because, you know, if something's lasted a few thousand years, there's pretty good stuff in it. And it's like important to understand how people thought this could improve life. And so I think it's really important to like try these things out and then come away not more certain. Often you come away less certain somehow. And then, but just seeing what the effects of living with a certain lens is and then continuing the investigation. And we've talked at other points about a kind of spectrum from, and we've drawn the dichotomy in different ways, but let's say from abstraction or reason on the one hand to experience and perception on the other hand.
Yes.
And I think it's important to like kind of push in both of these directions at once. Like look at the theoretical frameworks, look at the really abstract philosophy, see what you get from viewing the world in really rigid categories, and then go to the total opposite and say nothing is categorical. Like every individual experience is unique. There's, you know, anything in common between, you know, two trees of the same species is my projection onto that, you know, onto these two entirely unique phenomena, right? And so there's, I think there's a merit to like, and it's not just like swinging back and forth at random, and it's not a question of balance. It's almost like homeostasis, you know, like there's like a sympathetic and a parasympathetic nervous system, and they're both active systems that push in opposite directions. And I think that there is something important to be learned from that process of having experiences, attempting to make sense of them, categorizing them, trying to generalize from them. You know, if you have a ton of experiences and you never learn anything, you know, it's kind of a bit pointless to have those experiences. At the same time, if you live in a world of abstraction that never touches the testing or the proving or the challenge of unfiltered, uncut life, then you risk kind of remaining in this just sterile sort of ivory tower, right? And so and they're both failure modes. That's what I'm trying to argue. And they both require each other. You know, you can't just have reason and you can't just have experience. And that's why this is what I'm calling neither nor, which it's neither one nor the other. You always need both. But it's also, it's not just that you need both and you need a conceptual understanding that these two modes of reasoning, modes of being, modes of existence are present or are important, but actually knowing how to skillfully improvise and how to skillfully navigate between them. And that's what I think it requires practice.
Yes, I love that. And I think you also have written about the fact that this practice isn't a lone practice. It is not done in isolation with just yourself, right? And we do it with others live. Yes. We try these things out in conversation, in discussion, in living, in conflict, in harmony, and all of that. And I think that's extremely compelling that this isn't, because my sense of a lot of philosophy, even when it was the pragmatist talking, is that it's very much a let's sit down and think about my life and should I take it this way or that way, as opposed to feeling like we are part of a much larger organism that you know, I'm not going totally Gaia, but that there is, you know, the boundary between myself and you is porous, and that we are kind of in this together, and that this experimental as well as conceptual act, these acts have to be done together with others.
Yes. And thank you for saying that. I think there's a few things in there that are really important. One is, philosophy is not supposed to remain abstract, and it's not about being right about something in my view. And then the other thing is that it requires communities of practice, and that, yeah, I mean, that can be harder to get in this day and age, but I think people really want community at the moment. And I think that, you know, community building and learning how to navigate some of these really difficult apparent impasses in terms of polarization or being unable to take perspectives and things like that, you know, those things require practice. And we may not be getting that kind of practice for a number of reasons, but, you know, a breakdown of community is certainly one of them. You know, if you haven't got embodied conversations and people who are on some level committed to being in the same spaces or something like that, it's very hard to get the stability that you need to improve your life. And your life is always interconnected with the people around
you. Yes. And I would add that we need, community and physical spaces to do that in, to commune in. And we need a framework that's a living one, that's continued to be iterated on, that gives us a sense of what we're even trying at, right? Because I think once you have, language absolutely has its faults, and we have to default to experience, and for lack of a better word, to vibe sometimes, right? And we also need a sense of saying, what you just did right there feels to me like you crossed this particular boundary, or that we need to go back to how we're relating to one another, et cetera. So the framework really matters, so that we have something, so we have a language through which we can communicate our sense of what's working and what's not working. And then again, going back to experience is really important, which is why I think working on the neither nor approach does have to be embodied and social and also public. And this is why I love what we're doing in terms of just excavating it out and going from all sorts of directions and coming back to what the purpose here is.
Yeah, I think it's really important too. And just, I suppose that it's iterative, not just in your individual life, but, you know, as you were saying, in terms of resolving conflicts or, you know, within group dynamics, I think are just critically important to it. You know, I'm really interested in this argument that cognition starts in language, you know, that it comes out of conversation, and only later, as we come to be able to have conversations with ourselves, does something like what we experience as thinking happen, that, you know, it's first social and only later an ability that we can kind of go off and do on our own. And I think if that's the case, then it's really important to understand how it works socially and what we can learn if that is its origin, as opposed to assuming that the end point that we're at now must be the starting point. There's something very odd about assuming. It's like saying, well, we see cars today, so they must always have been here. Well, no.
I just love how we've now come back to dependent origination and backwards causality, because that's exactly what you're pointing to right now, this this assumption we've got it wrong. And I really want to come back to, in a whole new conversation, to the idea of intersubjectivity being the beginning. We start in an intersubjective state. We come out of mom's body, and that the first kind of experience is intersubjective. It is not independent. It is not pulled away from that.
It's entirely dependent. Yeah.
Entirely dependent. So ontogenetically it is. And then we can, of course, talk about it evolutionarily, where it's all social. We are evolved to be that. So let's put a bookmark in there and really come back to it. I can't wait. I don't know how I'm supposed to wait for a week before we talk about this more, but it's a good place to stop, I think.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay.